Yours had to be a very unusual PhD. I love it. It's so interesting because it's very interdisciplinary. Like, it's a lot like mine in that sense.
Hello, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 21 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, Justin and I start into a series about my dissertation. In it, we look at the question of whether and how culture matters in international relations. But first, here are the highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. Have you had any good coffee recently?
Yeah, I've had some good coffee, thanks due in part to a mutual friend of ours, Marcus, who's given me some coffee, but we've also shared some coffee together at his place. We've hung out a few times since you and I've talked last. Man, he makes good coffee. So that's been the good coffee I've had. Now, I've had other coffee as well that I will absolutely drink, but none of it is all that memorable.
I think in our last episode, one of our most recent ones, you had mentioned that you had had some terrible coffee. So this sounds like a good change of pace.
Man, I don't remember that now. Do you recall what the terrible coffee was that
or maybe it was that you hadn't had any good coffee. Maybe that's what it was.
Well, I will say this. So I play in this basketball league in the morning, and every now and then my buddy who lives right close by to me, he's not on the same team as I am, but sometimes we play against each other. So we'll ride to basketball together because we're playing in the same game. And we always tend to stop and get Starbucks afterwards. And it's usually like a cold brew or something. But what's crazy is I had been drinking Caribou cold brew for a while, right? Because it's just like, I've said this before on the podcast, but it's like right on my way, easy to get to. And then I had Starbucks again. I'm like, man, it's just so much better than Caribou. That's just my take. Now, for anybody who's a coffee like connoisseur out there, Starbucks isn't going to be on the top of anyone's list. But I was drinking it the other morning and I was like, man, this is actually pretty good compared to what I'm used to. So like, I'm sorry, but Caribou has got to be my least favorite coffee, period. Like, there's just, I'm not impressed by it any which way.
But that's like your main coffee place, right?
Well, the problem, between it being a stop on my way to work and then having it at work because it's the coffee they serve here, it's like probably 90% of the coffee that I drink these days, even though it's my least favorite.
Maybe it's that familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah, it could be that, but I also just think, there's something about it that just isn't, it's just not as good as all the rest, but
so
don't hear me complain too much. I still drink it every morning. So,
I wasn't a huge fan of Caribou coffee, but the one place that I really enjoyed it was I did my PhD in Mississippi. And so I was flying back and forth a lot for classes, and in the Mississippi, in the Gulfport airport, there is a Caribou. I mean, it's kind of like at the college, it's not a Caribou, but they serve Caribou coffee there. And I was like, oh, this is familiar, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Have you had any particular good coffee lately?
You know, I've had some decent coffee. I found a chain that I like. I think maybe they're based in Sweden. I'm not sure, but one of the things I really like, and of course this isn't the coffee part, but they have a cinnamon roll that has cardamom in it that I really, I really like that flavor. It's one that I don't know that I knew that I liked until I was having it here. Yeah. And so, pretty decent. I would say consistently decent coffee and a good cinnamon roll, which for some reason, like a strong cinnamon flavor, I haven't found a lot of here. So that,
Man, when we were in Alexanderplatz, you and I, what was that coffee shop?
What was it? I know exactly where it is. I can't think of what it's called right now. I feel like it's like Einstein or something.
But man, what was so impressive, the coffee was good, but the pastries so good. Were
the cake.
Incredible. The cake. That's so good.
Yeah. So what's a highlight been for you here this week?
Well, I don't know about this week, but maybe since the last time we've talked, a couple of weeks ago, we had our honors banquet here at Crown, which is basically an event where students who are candidates for our honors program come with their families. They interview for pretty much a full afternoon with us. And then they also have a chance to like have a meal with us and their family members. It was a great event. It was hectic leading up to it. Like all of the pieces that were required from people at Crown mm-hmm. to pull this event off. And the fact that it was much bigger this year than it was the previous year,
gotcha.
it was stressing everyone out, I think. but when the day arrived, like it went smoothly. And then the best part, our honors committee talks about this, where the best part is just talking with students.
Nice. Like, and this is both the current students and future students.
Yeah. This was another cool thing about our banquet this year is that all of the honors students who were our first cohort last year were participants in the day. They were participants in interviews. Mm. So they interviewed some of the really next
interesting.
Years. Yep. Not all of them did, but some of them did. They were participants in like a panel.
Yeah.
So they could answer questions for families and students. And then they also came to the meal. But it was a great event. It was, I don't know, I guess it's kind of like the Super Bowl for the for the honors program here, which means it's hectic to pull off. But I got so much help from people around here, people who are very good at their jobs. Nice. That helped make it go smoothly, but it's just the students. I mean, it's the interacting with students who, you know, are considering our program and who we were considering for the mm-hmm. program. That's the best part. Yeah. So it was a great day, and it was definitely a highlight.
Nice. That's great.
Yeah. How about for you?
I think, so a highlight from the last week or so, Jenny and I got a chance to talk with some friends who just had a baby, back in the States. And I think I was talking with one of my colleagues here today, and there's just kind of this thing of you get into, like, it's busy. We're very busy all the time. And so we don't always pay attention to the fact that we miss people. And so when you stop and like have a chance, I don't know, we had maybe a 2-hour conversation or something, and it was just really good. And so there's the pain of like, oh yeah, I really miss these people. But also like, I mean, we laughed more than we've been laughing for a long time, you know, that kind of thing. It was just really enjoyable, to remember friendship. Yeah. So I think that was a highlight for me.
Nice. That's great. What about a low light?
A low light for me, it just feels like there's a lot of heavy stuff right now in the world, which I guess I feel like that's always the case, but you know, there's giant earthquake that just happened, in Turkey,
man.
Syria,
that's terrible.
And, you know, there are a lot of both Turkish and Syrian people here in Berlin. And so just knowing that there are people here who have connection, direct connection to the, to the pain there, and all the loss there, I think, and not knowing really how to engage that, if there is any way to engage that. And then, you know, I think looming concern about the next stage of the war, in Ukraine. And, it's been this weird contrast this week of the sun has been out, which it wasn't for a long time. And, so the sun has been out, the days are getting longer. It's, you know, the kind of hopeful time of the year.
Yeah.
But man, the backdrop of some of the things going on in the world just really feel heavy. So how about for you?
Well, I had this interesting thing. Now, I remember talking with you some time ago where I was mentioning something. This is when you were working here with me, about having some conversation that bothered me. And it bothered me because of, like, I think some of the things that I'd said. And you gave me like a sheet or something that was a reflection. Do you remember that?
I do.
What is that?
The critical moment dialogue
that you give? Okay. So this is what I found happening to me. I had two conversations recently where I didn't even realize this, but one night I just woke up in the middle of the night, and like I was immediately feeling anxiety, and all of a sudden my mind was racing about these couple conversations that I'd had. Like I said this, I said that, I said this, I said that. And it was like, it was really bothering me. You know, just thoughts about it. I started to wonder like if I have some, at times have some like social anxiety or if it's maybe just, is that just normal? Is it normal to be in conversations with people and then later on go, I don't know if I should have said that. Oh, I don't know if I should have put it that way. I don't know. Do you do that?
Yeah. I think sometimes I'll even walk away and I'll find my face replaying the conversation. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's normal either.
Cause in the moment I'm feeling like, oh yeah, this is a great conversation. And then afterwards I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if I should have put that way. Right. I don't know if I, and it's like just second guessing, also feeling like, just some anxiety about it. And it happened to me now twice over the course of a very recent period. And it just was unsettling to me. And so then I'm like, well, am I just overthinking it? Or did I really put my foot in my mouth all that much? You know, you know me, I tend to think out loud a bit.
Sure, sure.
At times. And so sometimes I'll be, you know, just processing something verbally. And then afterwards I'll be like, maybe I should have thought about that first before I said anything to anybody.
I think the advantage of when that, so I hate it when that happens in the classroom, but the advantage of that in the classroom is that I can come back and make a correction. Right.
I can come back.
Be like, guys, you know what? I said this and I was wrong. And you know, here's the thing, or here's how I would have preferred that I had articulated it. But in a personal conversation, that's a lot harder sometimes.
Yeah. And for me, it wasn't the classroom. It was personal conversations. Mm-hmm. But it's just things I was kind of rethinking.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm realizing is what it happens is I think at the core of my anxiety is this idea of like, what are they going to think about me?
Right. Right.
You know, by me sharing that or sharing this or saying that, should I toned it down? Should I have said it differently? Should I put it differently? Should I kept that thought or view to myself? Like that kind of thing. So it's just something that was unsettling to me.
Yeah.
I think I'm, you know, it's not anything new. I've had those feelings in the past, but it just happened to have a couple conversations right around the same time where this thing was coming up. So that I would call that a low light.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you end up pulling out the critical moment dialogue sheet or?
I did not. No. In fact, I don't even know where it is. I maybe I'll have to have you send it to me again. What's an insight that you have from the past week or a few weeks?
I think, insight that I have. Okay. So this is a little bit, this was almost going to be my highlight. My son, my youngest son bought a Wii last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's been wanting it for a couple of weeks. I don't know. Maybe a couple of months. I don't know when he started wanting it, but we had one in the US and it was one of those things we just didn't bring with us. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we didn't compared to some of the things we did bring. Anyway, he had, I think, been having this memory of how much fun it had been to play together on the Wii. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, kind of put together, you know, allowance and Christmas money and some money that he'd gotten from grandma and grandpa and put that together. And then I helped him buy the Wii. And it was, you know, one of those things where I knew it was going to cost more than he thought it was going to cost. He had found this great deal, you know, and then, you know, like, okay. Yeah. I know it says 9 for 3 remotes and nunchucks, but actually that's not right. You know?
Yeah.
We've been playing though the last couple of days, the Wii, and it's just been so much fun. And I think, like all 5 of us have been playing some.
Well, I have a quick question for you about it.
Yeah.
It's a silly one, but it's something I wonder. When you buy a Wii in Germany, does it have the German electrical plug?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, good. I figured so, but I was like, you know, I mean, the Wiis aren't being made in America either. I suspect so. But it makes sense to me, but it's something I never really had thought of before.
But I think, so last week the kids had vacation and we took a couple of days vacation and went to, among other things, we went to a video game museum here in Berlin,
oh, nice.
Which was fantastic. Like, I don't know what I expected, but it was great. It's not real big, but it was super interesting and interactive and kind of telling the story of video games. And then it was like the day after that, I think that the Wii came, or maybe that night even. I think the insight is somewhere around the idea that, you know, I mentioned all the heavy stuff, all the dark stuff that's going on, but there is a really important place for fun and having fun together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think, that's it. How about for you?
No, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. Yeah. For me, my insight's very unrelated to everything we've been talking about to some extent. I just had realized, and I think I'd mentioned this somewhere on the podcast before, but I realized, you know, I teach a Romans class, which is Paul's letter to mm-hmm. the Romans. And I just realized this is my 38th and 39th time having taught it. Yeah. Cause I teach it 5 times a year and will be the end of my 8th year.
So that?
When I teach it this summer, it'll be my 40th time having taught it.
Yeah.
40th semester having taught it.
My goodness.
Which is pretty crazy to think about.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring it up is because I just recently came across a book and some ideas by talking with some people in the field that completely has started to shift how I think about it. I'll think about Romans. I'm like, man, I've taught this 38 times. For one, it's a reminder to me of like how important it is for people in academic settings to be consistently like engaging things in their field.
Yeah, to keep learning, right?
Yeah, you keep learning. And it's like all of a sudden you read one thing, you're like, wow, I never thought of that before. I never saw it that way, but it's very compelling. Then it doesn't just keep the classroom fresh, but it, I think, is also an opportunity to model for students that, like, hey, we need to approach these subjects with humility, knowing that it's okay to have confidence, but also, like, man, you never know when you're going to come across something that might really be a game changer for how you see this particular subject. Right. And that's encouragement to continually seek to explore the subject more and deeper. And that's not a fearful thing, but it's an exhilarating thing in some ways. So yeah, that came across some interesting ideas on it. And it wasn't surprising to me, but it was refreshing in a lot of ways to think, wow, I've been teaching this certain idea about Romans for a while, and I think I need to change it.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
Can I ask you what it is? Justin gives a fascinating answer to this question. Supporters of the podcast can find it on our Patreon at patreon.com/profsandrooms. We'll be back in a moment with the discussion of culture and international relations.
So your dissertation had several interdisciplinary components to it. It's something I think I really enjoyed about your work. And so it makes me just kind of curious and makes me wonder a little bit, what field of study do you feel like your dissertation fits best within?
I mean, so technically, right, the program was an international development PhD program, and my major was security studies, which would be like international relations. And then my minor was political development. And so, so international relations, I would say, is kind of the anchor field. However, I came in from the beginning, I had to get into the program, I wrote a research program description. I don't remember what they called it, but some kind of a thing saying, what are you wanting to research? And I had said, look, I've got a master's in intercultural relations, and I want to bring in, I want to study that in the context of international development. And I remember saying in that initial research program proposal, saying, like, I will bring the intercultural perspective. I'm not expecting the program to have it. And I think I remember my first advisor saying something like, gosh, that sounded a little like, I don't know, self-promoting, or that's not the right word, but like, kind of this thing of...
Does it sound like you were taking a jab at the program?
Maybe, I don't know. But like, but the reality is the program didn't have the perspective that I wanted them to have. And what I was trying to say is, don't worry, I'm not asking you to learn it. I'm going to bring it. And then but I need to learn what you guys know so I can bring this. And so anyway, yeah, so it is an interdisciplinary study. And I think part of what's interesting is there's a big difference between, in my mind anyway, a big difference between an interdisciplinary study and a multidisciplinary study. And my goal really was an interdisciplinary study.
Definitely. Yeah, I caught that. And it's interesting for our listeners, they're going to be able to pick up, I think, on more of that interdisciplinarity when we get to your methodology. But I it's so fascinating. There's about 2/3 of this dissertation that you wrote that I wish I had written. And then there's like 1/3 of it that there's no way I could have written. And this is what I mean, is that you're actually engaging with disciplines that are extremely interesting to me. I mean, you have this global Christian reasoning is what you call it, right?
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners what it is that you engage. I mean, we'll have a chance to cover this more in your method, but just, I think this will be a good intro to see kind of how this project was interdisciplinary. So what was this global Christian reasoning?
Well, I mean, so it might be helpful to back up and say, well, what was I trying to do and why did I need to engage that?
Let's pause that question. That's a good idea. I'm very interested to hear your take on what prompted you to address this particular subject. So we haven't really stated what the subject is yet. Maybe we need to do that, right?
Yeah, I that's probably a good idea. I think we do. So the basic question, I have my specific research questions, but really kind of the background question is, does culture matter and do cultural differences matter in international relations? And I think it's funny because when I mention what I was researching to people who have studied culture at all, there's kind of this like, why would you even need to study that? There's kind of like, obviously it matters. Yeah. But the way that the political science world deals with the concept of culture is quite different than the way that the intercultural communication world deals with the concept of culture. Yeah. I just, was continually disappointed when I came across the culture concept in international relations. And so, yeah, I was trying to say, does culture as we understand it over here in intercultural communication and intercultural relationships, does that idea of culture matter in international relations? So, and international relations, looking at interactions between two, I'll probably use the word states quite a bit as we're talking about this, but the idea of states being countries, right? So two different countries, do cultural differences between them matter? This actually turns out is an incredibly complicated question for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah. I think I picked up, I think it might be worth bringing that. You can decide whether you want to just squash this, but I think what I picked up in your introduction was that there seems to be a couple of reasons why this isn't an obvious question in international relations, even though, like you said, if you're talking to culture people, this is kind of like what are you talking about? Of course it matters. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned at one point that there's a certain squishiness.
And that's not my word.
The definitions of culture. Yeah. That's interesting. I guess I assumed it was your word, but
no, I don't think it was my word anyway. I think that's somebody else's.
So there's been an acknowledgement of squishiness.
Yeah. I don't think it was my word. I think somebody else had,
That's Putt, Smitch, and Walk. Well, maybe I'll just try to comment quickly here on, so to me, it sounds like the reason why this question isn't all that obvious, and you'll get more into that when you actually do your literature review, but it's number one, that there's a certain squishiness to the definition of culture in international relations. And then also something you mentioned that was interesting is that while there are these two sort of, there's these two fields of study that seem to intersect in many ways, right? You've got intercultural communication and how did you put it? Intercultural
and international relations.
Yeah, international relations and intercultural studies in a lot of ways. And yet you mentioned in your first chapter that they don't always converse exactly and they don't always intersect in the ways that you would expect them to.
There's very few examples that I had found when I was doing the project of a real actual interaction between those two perspectives. And even sometimes there was this one book I was so excited. I was like, I finally found it. Here's the book. And what it was instead was essays from, or chapters, you know, written by people who came from one perspective and people who came from another perspective, you know, from those two disciplines, but really hardly any interaction between them. And I found a number of things like that. There are a few documents that I had found, a few resources that actually really engage the question of what happens when those come together, but there's not much. Huh. Yeah, which I think is just, it feels shocking when you are a student of culture that there would be, and I'm already like, my brain is crying like, no, you got to define culture, but that's a whole other question. But
well, you get to that plenty in your first chapter.
I think there's, or second chapter. Part of what launched me into this question was, maybe 10 years before I really started writing it was longer than that even. Yeah, about 10 years before I started writing the dissertation, I was at a conference and there was somebody presenting from the U.S. Institute for Peace and they were talking about conflict negotiation that they were doing in a live hot conflict zone. And as they were presenting, they were talking through their different processes that they go through. And I just remember being really bewildered that culture was not mentioned and that cultural frameworks weren't being used. And that even though and so I asked the question in the session, I said, hey, like these are all really good things that you're talking about for negotiating conflict and coming to some kind of a peace agreement. But like, how do you translate these, not just linguistically, but also culturally, so they make sense to the people you're interacting with? And the person that was presenting just had a complete blank look. Just no understanding. And I had given a few examples of what I meant. I said, like, how do you take this from high context to low context, or from low context to high context? And how do you take this from, you know, low power distance to high power distance? I just remember the response was, well, you know, yeah, culture really matters to people. Like their religion is very important to them. And I was like, oh, you don't understand what they're talking about at all. Yes, of course, people's religion is very important to them, but that's not the question I'm asking. Right. And so for the 10 years after that, I kept kind of looking for this intersection. Like, where is this? Where are people talking about this? And I kept finding disappointingly few interactions around that space.
Yeah. And at one point you even say that there's often perhaps an assumption in international relations that someone might be a bad actor. That's what, I think that's the word that you use, bad actor, a phrase.
In other words, bad faith actor.
Yeah. Sorry. Not bad actor. Yep. So yeah, they use this phrase, bad faith actor, which I think, I mean, how do you define that? Because it's very interesting. I think this point that you're making about bad faith actors, as not always being the main reason for conflict occurring. And then essentially what you're saying is it's not always that. Instead, it could be cultural difference instead of someone being sort of a bad faith actor, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, so that was a question I was asking. I was at a different conference, maybe, well, 10 years later, while I was beginning to work on the dissertation, and had asked the question of somebody who, I'm trying to think of how to characterize this person. I think the way I mentioned it in the dissertation is that somebody who is a senior member of a international award granting institution that said, basically culture is used as an excuse by bad faith actors to abuse human rights. And on the one hand, I think, sure, that's probably true. That in some cases, I mean, and you see that even, you know, there's kind of in pop that idea has made it into pop culture. Like, oh yeah, you know, you can't make me do that. It's my culture or whatever. You've offended me. That's my culture. Sure. Or, you know, that there's that kind of a feel. And so I think, yeah, maybe there's a point there, but that doesn't take away from the question of, can there be real honest misunderstandings between good faith actors, you know, actors who are attempting to represent on their position honestly, you know, and for a variety of reasons end up coming to different conclusions about what an interaction meant or interpret a text differently. And not just because of linguistic reasons. Of course, that adds a huge layer of complexity on its own. But then when you add cultural differences, and this has to do with everything from, I mean, there's epistemological questions. There are all these things around logic and knowing, you know, reasoning, all those kinds of things. And then, you know, questions about abstractness versus concreteness and what does it mean to honor the humanity of another when there are different definitions, even of kind of fundamentally as a person, an individual or part of a group. And they're, you know, generally we perceive people as both, they're an individual and they're a part of a group, but which of those is more important? Which of those is first? Those kinds of things really change how we perceive what certain ideas mean. You know, what is the fundamental nature of humanity? Is it good? Is it neutral? Is it evil? Right. Those kinds of things, you know, what is the fundamental nature of life? Is it to suffer or is it to conquer? You know, I mean, there's kind of all of these different things that culturally have all sorts of variations possible. And part of my question is, I'm just kind of naming the things that come up the top of my mind, right? But the list of things that potentially go into that culture, you know, bucket of things that we could draw from to say, how could we be different from each other goes so, 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 so deep. And so the question of like, is it possible that well-meaning, good intentioned actors that are really trying to solve a problem maybe are not seeing the same problem or maybe are not having the same communication event, even though they're trying to?
Yeah. And that's where your dissertation is part hermeneutics. It's very interesting. Like, it really made me think on a couple of things. Number one, that it was fascinating that my PhD advisor, Torsten Moritz, was on your committee because of his interest in hermeneutics, but also in his desire to see hermeneutics implemented in fields outside of biblical studies and outside of literature studies or literary studies or historical studies. It was fascinating. I think it probably was a perfect fit in some ways for him to be on your committee for this project, because you explain a little bit about how hermeneutics comes into play for your question. But the reason why I ask it this early is because of that UDHR, what's to say, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you just raised the possibility. You don't answer anything early on, but you raised the possibility in chapter one that like two people could be reading that document very differently from their cultural perspectives. And that one group or one state could think they're in compliance, the other could think that same state is not. And this might not be a matter of again, bad faith actors, or this might be a matter of actually hermeneutics and how they read this particular document. And that, I mean, as a biblical studies person, I'm so sympathetic to this, but then I'm also so shocked that it's not even really been a major discussion in the field, apparently, right? Like, this apparently, is one thing that surprised me so much about your dissertation. And I remember even when you're working on it thinking, wait a second, no one's asked that question before. That isn't to put you down. If anything, it's actually to say the opposite. well, yeah, but it's actually the opposite. In some ways, I'm thinking, how is it possible that this hasn't already been done? Like it seems, and I think it what it points to is how important your project actually is, because apparently it has not yet been done with any sufficiency prior to your work. You do address in your literature review and whatnot some of the ways that these things have intersected in certain places, but I think you pretty well established there that you know, actually your project is quite necessary, of which, and then I say of course it is, but then I also step back and go, wait, so these states on international scales have been interacting in some of the biggest world conflicts that we've ever seen without a single real awareness that this is a reality.
So I had a conversation with a guy once who had done a research project for, I believe it was for the State Department. I'm fairly confident of that. And, he had, been hired to look at this question of, you know, cultural difference in diplomacy. Right. And, and had asked the question, his methodology was like, hey, you know, who are the best diplomats basically? And how do they work? And his findings pointed to intercultural competence as being a really important component of that. So he had done this work, but when he turned it in, the person who read it was like, yeah, this is all great. And now it's classified and you cannot do anything with it. And, you know, and they basically just sat on it as buried. Right. And so it's like, because it was too sensitive, the nature of it. Wow. So it's not that nobody has asked the question, but there are all sorts of reasons that it isn't rising to the front.
So your main question is then related to the impact of culture in international relations. How do you think you would state that as a what problem, if is that a right way to put it? What problem do you think your dissertation is trying to solve?
I think
is that not the right way to put it?
It's fine. Yeah, because I think that the way that I would specify the problem would be to say that we imagine that the range of difference across cultures is far less than it actually is. And my attempt basically is to say, I want to broaden the understanding of the actual range of difference. And then to say it, and then really to look at the question of, does it matter? And then actually also to look at the question, what do you do about it? And the dissertation ends up touching all of those points.
So maybe it'd be helpful for our listeners to kind of walk through just briefly how you end up exploring this subject.
Yeah. So
like a big picture, is that okay? A big picture overview. Yeah, so definitely. In terms of just what I'm thinking of is your work with GCR. So basically kind of how you take your questions and then your hypotheses. So that kind of a little bit of an outline of where you go with this, right?
Sure. So
what's a big picture overview of your project in terms of where you end up taking, how do you end up addressing that question specifically?
So the first thing that I do is I raise three specific questions. So the first question is, do cultural differences meaningfully affect the ability of actors from different cultures to arrive at shared meanings of shared texts and events, right? Which is this hermeneutical piece you were mentioning. And that question is very intentionally not tied to international relations. It's saying, does this exist in the world? Like, is this a thing? And then the second is to say, okay, does that matter in international relations? And then the third is, does intercultural adaptation meaningfully attenuate or, you know, affect the ways in which those differences affect outcomes in the conduct of international relations? So those are the three questions. And then those move into hypotheses, right? So the first hypothesis is that cultural differences meaningfully affect the ability of culturally different international actors to arrive at shared meanings from shared texts and events.
Yeah. Could you share a little bit about how you end up arriving at that conclusion in terms of what lens do you use?
Well, so that's just the hypothesis.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. And I wasn't familiar with how those work, questions and hypotheses and some of these kinds of things, because that's not really the language we use, but
it's very different than biblical studies, isn't it?
It is. But I think you end up working your hypotheses through the lens. You look at a particular group of people.
I do,
in order to really explore that. Right.
So my program, was through Southern Miss, University of Southern Mississippi. You know, it's not a religious institution. It's a state university. And I come from a background of working at a Christian college, and I mm-hmm. have done some work with, being, you know, aware of contextual theologies and things like that. And I had been really wrestling with this question of, okay, people in international relations don't seem to believe that culture, the way that I'm talking about it, actually exists. And so I can't even have the conversation. There have been a few attempts within international relations to have the culture conversation, and they keep stalling out. And there's, I think Landis says a couple of articles where he looks at the culture concept in international relations and really comes to this conclusion that it got sidetracked by the civilizational studies, particularly Huntington, who became a popular author. Popular in that it escaped scholarship, it moved beyond scholarship and actually had an effect in the world too. But the culture question in international relations wasn't healthy enough. The status of the study of that wasn't healthy enough to be able to build on it there. I wasn't going to be able to say, see, look, these authors within international relations have said this and this and this. And so then I can take all that and answer the question. So instead I went outside. This was one of those things I had been wrestling with this problem for months, I think. And I was driving to work one day. That's a sentence I haven't said for a while because I haven't driven in a year and a half. But anyway, I was driving to work one day, and if I remember, my feeling is that I was in prayer about this, you know, like just kind of like one of those very open-ended prayer conversations. And mm-hmm. You know, there was just this very clear sense of, hey, like you already know. Like you already have access to this whole group with, you know, and I had a little difficulty defining it at first, but eventually came to calling it just global Christian reasoning, which is the GCR you've mentioned. Because one of the problems within international relations is people have said, okay, sure, there are cultural differences, but everybody who does international relations is in the same epistemic community.
What do you mean by that, epistemic community, for our listeners who might not know what that means?
Yeah. So they basically all learn to think in similar ways around similar topics, right? So international relations scholars around the world often are accessing similar texts. I honestly don't know what the limits of that are. I don't know, you know, if international relations scholars, you know, whose primary schooling is outside of English, I don't know if they're accessing the same texts that we are. That would be an interesting study in and of itself. I've been to International Studies Association's conferences, including one in Hong Kong, and the conversation that we were having, you know, that's an epistemic community, right? You're interacting with the same people around the same people. You're doing the same thing when you go to the conferences you recently went to for Society of Biblical Literature, right? That's an epistemic community.
Yeah, it sounds like they're an epistemic community because they have a certain set of shared interest in the subject, maybe even some shared questions, some shared stake in the game in terms of how these questions are answered for their particular global, you know, circumstances and situation.
And shared assumptions, right, about how you ask the questions and answer questions about those things.
Yeah, but it sounds also like you have these sort of shared components, but then you lean into how culture might differ among that, right?
Yeah. So I looked at the question of Christian people doing, and I defined it a little bit more narrowly and said, okay, primarily, what we can kind of loosely call like a Protestant, maybe evangelical Christian reasoning. And say, okay, this is a relatively small group of people around the world that is a, you know, identifiable epistemic community, and with a commitment to actually just one primary text, with the Bible, right? And so there would be, if you applied the reasoning that I was hearing from the political science side and from the international relations side in particular, say, okay, really, they have so much in common. right? A shared history of, you know, basically 2000 years of development of reasoning and whatnot, that like, yeah, they're going to disagree, but their disagreements are going to be within that epistemic community. And culture really shouldn't matter is if you took the same reasoning from political science. And so then my question was, well, can I find culture making a difference, cultural differences making a difference in how this community is interacting with these thoughts?
Yeah, and it seems then, right, like that when you address this particular epistemic community, global Christian reasoning, you're doing so to first establish the idea that culture actually does matter in the world when it comes to some differences and disagreements, even within epistemic communities that would normally, say, perhaps agree on quite a bit of things. Mm-hmm. So if you can establish that, right, that sounds like the first part of your dissertation, where if you can establish that, then you can perhaps move that away from the realm of global Christian reasoning and into the field of international relations. So like you said, the question on whether culture is even impacting those communities isn't a given. So you're looking at that stage in your dissertation to just establish that reality with this particular epistemic community, right?
Yeah. And that's, I don't know if we'll get into the methodology more in a different episode, but that, sure. I think we should.
I just love methodology so much that, and I think it's so important for your work in a lot of ways, like it was for mine, that I think we probably should lean into it. It's just so interesting.
Yeah. So maybe I'll leave that there, man. But that was kind of the basic question of like, can I find it at play? Yeah. And so, yeah, in the methodology, we can talk some about how I controlled for that too, and my own biases in the midst of that.
But it sounds like so far you've set up this big question that you have this hunch about, right? That culture matters more in international relations than it's been given weight to. But first you need to establish that culture matters in the world in ways that the international relations community hasn't acknowledged. And so you have this epistemic community that you call global Christian reasoning, and then you do some work in that first part to try to demonstrate where culture may come into play in that particular community. So then where do you go after that? You make a shift then away from this particular community, right, into moving into international relations?
Yeah. So it's this weird thing of, on the one hand, I had to set up where will I go if the answer is yes, it does matter. And then I also had to set up where will I go if it doesn't? And so
you one quick question about that? Yeah. How much of that did you have a certain openness to? I mean, I think in your gut, you probably, please correct me if I'm wrong. In your gut, did you really think, I think this is going to yield yes results, right? These factors do matter. Or did you really not know how it was going to land?
So I would say it's both. I definitely had a gut feeling that it's like, yeah, I mean, yes, this matters because I'm reading contextual theologies and blah, blah, blah. The question that I wasn't sure about is, can I find any evidence that that's actually because of cultural differences in the way that I'm talking about them?
That's important.
And sometimes I didn't. Like there were sources that I was super excited about. I was like, okay, this is going to for sure have it. And it didn't, you know, and I was like, like there was a little while, and I remember you had a similar feeling on, part of your project, there was a little while where I was sweating out. I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm gonna find it. And of course you have to be open to that, right? Like if it's real research project, like you gotta say, yeah, I mean, I could be wrong here. And so I had this out that was like, if I can't find it, you know, here's my backup plan. Here's my second backup plan. If I still can't find it, then the project ends at that point. And the answer is no, I can't demonstrate that it matters outside. And so I'm not going to try to demonstrate that it matters inside of political science, international relations.
I'm finding this sort of trajectory really helpful. Do you think it's okay? I'm going a little off script from what we had on the.
I feel like it's such a
picture overview.
Yeah, because it's really such a helpful, messy project to try to even understand what on earth was I doing.
Well, no, it wasn't messy at all. I think though the problem is that you know it so well, and I have a pretty good awareness of what you're up to. The trickiest part is trying to convey that to our listeners. Mm-hmm. So that's why I feel like it's actually quite helpful to kind of just go step by step through.
Yeah. Okay. Like, no, that makes sense.
What were you doing? How do you do it? And then we can kind of dig deeper into some of the more particulars if you find that helpful. But I think this will be helpful for our listeners to sort of get them on track with the big picture.
Yeah. So maybe it's probably worth mentioning too, before I could do anything with the global Christian reasoning, I had to stop and define culture, which is the literature review goes largely into that. And what a pain it is to define culture. But we can talk about that in a different episode. But that was something that had to happen before I could do the global Christian reasoning piece.
And by pain, I think you mean around 70 pages of pain in that your literature review was robust. But I think what that speaks to, and we can talk more about the details of that, but what it speaks to is the need to actually show the murkiness or what you maybe call the squishiness of the way that culture has been addressed or used within international relations or not used within international relations, right? So you get to the, all right, I'm going to look at this epistemic community, but before you even do that, right, you have to spend 70 pages exploring what has been said about culture. Mm-hmm. And so we can definitely dig into that in more detail in another episode. But I think that we don't want to overlook that, right? That was a very important part of your work here, because you don't want to just assume that culture and the definition of culture is all that well accepted, right, within the field. Mm-hmm. Great. So you move from, okay, you do some hard work and heavy lifting to talk about the murkiness of culture within the field. Then you look at the impact or potential impact of culture on this epistemic community, global Christian reasoning. And after that, you're then moving it away from the field of global Christian reasoning and into international relations, right?
So after I defined culture, then I defined cultural differences in the methodology that I was going to look for. And then that's what I went and looked for. So that was part of the unknowing, is saying, okay, instead of just saying I will, any evidence of cultural difference, I'll just pull that in, right? Like a big vacuum or a big magnet. Mm. Instead, I was going to say, I'm only going to look for these ones that I think I have a reasonable hunch are going to matter in international relations. And then based on the idea that these seem to be relatively well accepted cultural differences, cultural difference frameworks, I'm then going to go look for them in the global Christian reasoning. Mm. And then, so that was part of the unknowing, was not defining those topics primarily out of that, not defining them in the way global Christian reasoning would tend to define them, but defining them a different way outside of that literature, and then bringing that in to that literature, and then saying, is it there? And then if yes, then what? And then that gets to the question that you were asking of bringing it back into international relations.
And how do you end up doing that? How do you end up bringing it back into international relations?
So this again was like, oh man, such a puzzle, because I was like, okay, what kind of methodology could I use that would be reasonably effective at demonstrating whether or not this matters, and where I can get enough resources? And part of the difficulty is that in international relations, many of the statements that are made are not, so there's this idea of two-level games, right? Where state actors are often speaking both for an internal audience as well as for an external audience. And that also means that sometimes public statements don't match the truthfulness of those statements can be difficult to assess, because the intended impact, and this is international communication gets into that some, which is a whole other question, you know, and the use of media to communicate ideas. But that's what that means, though, is that the public record is iffy, you know, for that. And then, of course, you know, trying to get primary sources is difficult. I had some good conversations with people that helped frame some of this, but I was trying to say, okay, what what could I do? What I ended up settling on was a case study design using three different case studies, two that were intended to be similar to each other, and one that was a totally different kind of experience in the sense that it had a very different outcome. So that's part of case study design, where you have most similar cases and most different cases, and tried to use those and tried to pick cases that I could get enough sources on that I could really kind of develop them. And then I used an approach called a counterfactual.
Yeah, I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, so it's super interesting. So counterfactual analysis. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsandrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.